Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget too big to fail. What about just small enough to fail? MF Global goes under and the system barely notices. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's Halloween. That makes it the 31st of October. And what could actually have been a scary day in the financial markets to start the week passed with barely a hiccup. A company called MF Global filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy this morning. Nothing at all unusual about that. Happens all the time. Except this particular filing for this particular firm turned on miscalculations about European debt and a healthy dose of Wall Street hubris and the expectation that somebody would be there to bail them out when the time came. For the details, the time has come. We've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on the line. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So first of all, I suppose the nuts and bolts. What was it that this company did?
Well, a lot of people wouldn't have heard of it. MF Global trades commodities, wheat futures, pork bellies, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it usually helps institutions do that. So regular people don't do business with it. But the only reason anyone would have heard of this who's not in finance is that it's run by John Corzine, who's the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, former governor of New Jersey. And what's interesting about this as well is that MF Global has a history of getting into trouble. In fact, back in 2008, they had a rogue trader. They lost $141 million on wheat futures. They survived, but clearly they didn't learn the lesson.
Well, so get us to today. What happened that they came to such woes?
So what they did was they took too much exposure to European government debt. And, you know, everyone's been suspicious about that when it comes to big banks like Bank of America or Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan. But no one thinks about how that affects smaller firms like MF Global. So MF Global managed to accumulate $6.3 billion of European government bonds, which is really impressive considering that at its biggest this year, MF Global was worth, as a firm, $1.3 billion.
Right.
So five times their size, they piled this stuff on. And the basic thing they said to investors was, hey, don't worry, Europe's going to get a bailout. We're going to be fine. No way can this go wrong.
Key point, right? They borrowed to buy this debt that is in bad shape and then said to the people who were buying their own bonds, we're going to get bailed out. Don't worry about it.
Right. And investors said, we've seen this movie before. In fact, they've probably seen Margin Call, the movie, which is exactly this plot. And they said, no way. And they started backing away. Research analysts started to take notice. Moody's cut MF Global's debt to junk last week. And after that, it was just an orderly unwind. It was like the weekend of Lehman Brothers if no one had panicked.
It is, one could say, MF Global was small enough to fail, not too big to fail, right?
That's exactly right. And in many ways, it's a very satisfying morality tale. We're in this time of Occupy Wall Street. A lot of people are very dissatisfied with Wall Street in general. And this is moral hazard, right? Excessive risk taking. Here, the firm fails. It happens in an orderly way. It doesn't take down the financial system. And everyone feels that this is the way things are supposed to work. We're not supposed to stop financial firms from failing. But if they must fail due to their own actions, shouldn't it be this way, in a way that doesn't hurt too many other people?
Yeah, here's the unknowable, though. We don't know how many other MF Globals are out there.
Right. We have absolutely no idea. Think about how long it took for people to realize that MF Global had picked up a bet that was five times its own size, right? Or think about Dexia, the French bank that no one saw in trouble until the last minute. There are a lot of these bets that happened in the financial system that don't come to light until it is at the point of just a massive crisis for that firm. Right. And you have to believe, just by the numbers, that there's more of this out there than we know about.
Heidi Moore in New York on the MF Global story for us. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, so we'll take a turn now from a story of excessive risk to a story, it can fairly be argued, that is of excessive pay. Today's example comes to us not from the halls of finance, whence you might think, but rather from the booming oil fields. The drilling company Nabors is making headlines for giving its longtime CEO Eugene Eisenberg a $100 million severance package. Best part of the whole deal? He's not really getting severed at all. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Nabors chairman and CEO Eugene Eisenberg has headed up the oil drilling company since 1987. And in spite of his $100 million golden parachute, he's not actually parachuting anywhere. Eisenberg won't be the CEO anymore, but he'll remain chairman. Ralph Ward publishes Boardroom Insider, a corporate governance newsletter.
It doesn't seem quite right to have that rich of a severance amount for someone who really isn't being severed.
Golden parachutes were originally created as an anti-takeover device. Companies put them in place so a hostile bidder might balk at the king's ransom it would take to oust the CEO. Hostile takeovers were not deterred, and the golden parachutes just kept getting bigger. Charles Elson teaches corporate governance at the University of Delaware.
To give someone effectively an entrepreneurial style fortune for termination, I think some would view as problematic.
The payout to Eisenberg is bigger than Nabors' most recent quarterly profit. Nabors did not respond to requests for comment. Business ethics expert Chris McDonald says new financial regulations and increasingly vigilant shareholders are forcing companies to make executive pay packages more transparent.
Pressure from major institutional investors and from shareholders more generally who are just saying, look, the board has a very specific role to play here, and it's not just to be pals with the CEO.
In fact, 2 years ago, shareholders pressured Nabors to cut Eisenberg's severance package. His previous golden parachute, more than $260 million. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
So you know how there's been this big push the past couple of years to clean up ads directed at children, mostly about junk food and sugary drinks? Well, there's a new study out about those drinks and the ads for them. Researchers at Yale say kids are actually seeing more ads for that kind of stuff than they used to. It's a pattern that's especially true for Black and Hispanic children and teenagers. Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
The researchers used data from the Nielsen Company. They discovered Black children and teenagers saw 80 to 90% more ads for sugary drinks than white children and teenagers. Researcher Marlene Schwartz says to keep something in mind.
Black children and teens do watch more television than average white children and teens.
But she says that can't explain everything.
That suggests to us that these companies have deliberately chosen to place their ads in media where they know that Black children and teenagers will be watching.
They've also targeted another demographic.
We found that Hispanic children saw 49% more ads for sugary drinks and energy drinks, and the teens saw 99% more ads.
A lot of those were on Spanish-language TV and radio stations. Advertisers also use games and other gimmicks on the Internet. The American Beverage Association said in a statement, drink makers advertise only water, juice, and milk on programming for children under 12.
That's actually not true.
Susan Lynn heads the campaign for a commercial-free childhood.
When it comes to marketing sugary beverages to children, self-regulation just doesn't work.
Advertising is limited on children's shows, but Marlene Schwartz says only half the ads kids see are on those programs. Family shows are fair game. Just look at American Idol, sponsored by Coca-Cola. The judges have giant red cups with the Coke logo. It's not a kid's show, but plenty of children watch it. I'm David Gura from Marketplace.
Dateline Athens, the original one on this next story. Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou wants a little help deciding whether or not he should agree to the European bailout plan that was announced last week. So he's going to put it to a vote, a public referendum. No details, not even a date, which means this story's going to drag on for who knows how much longer. Papandreou told Parliament today Greek citizens will be called on to say, and this is a quote, a big yes or a big no to the loans. It's a story that just keeps getting better and better. On Wall Street today, it just keeps getting worse and worse. Traders follow their colleagues on European exchanges down into negative territory. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Super Committee holds its fifth public hearing tomorrow. 12 ordinary members of Congress suddenly given the power to cut $1.2 trillion from the federal budget. There's been no real sign of progress so far, which isn't surprising, says commentator Chris Roberson.
Ever since I was a kid, I've been obsessed with Superman, the Super Friends, the Legion of Superheroes, and too many other super people to mention. So I have certain expectations whenever the prefix super is put on the front of a word. Namely, that the thing in question should be, well, actually super. Which brings me to the so-called Super Committee, a congressional creation meant to end gridlock over the deficit. Unfortunately, it has fallen victim to the very forces it was intended to defeat. It's not faster than a speeding amendment, or more powerful than a filibuster, and it doesn't soar over gridlock. Instead, the Super Committee seems as helpless as Superman when he's been rendered powerless by a blast of red sun radiation, or, worse yet, kryptonite. But I think the trouble with the Super Committee can be traced to its secret origin. It didn't get bitten by a radioactive spider, or struck by lightning, or bathed in cosmic rays. The problem is, the Super Committee just didn't gain the right powers. Superheroes like Superman and the Flash are able to travel faster than the speed of light. They can move through time at will. Imagine a super committee with the ability to go back in time and undo key bits of legislation before they had a disastrous effect on the economy. Or travel forwards in time and see what the effects of legislation they're currently considering will really be. But that's just the beginning. The leader of the X-Men, Professor X, can read minds. Wouldn't it be cool if committee members could all read each other's minds? So they each knew what the others were really thinking? No more subterfuge or subtlety, just an open, honest discourse. And then there's Matter Eater Lad, with the ability to, well, eat anything. Imagine a world in which the Super Committee could simply eat the deficit. But the Super Committee's secret origin is set in stone, sadly, and barring some sort of retroactive continuity change, we're stuck with the powers they've been given. Not so super.
Chris Roberson reads and writes a whole lot of comic books. He's a former writer for Superman. Send us your comments. Marketplace.org is the website.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit Carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
There's a certain necessary arbitrariness in a lot of economic measurements. Somebody's got to decide how much inflation is good and how much is too much, how much unemployment is fine and how much isn't. Right now, the Census Bureau draws its line in the sand on poverty. It's actually called the poverty line. If the income for a family of four is below roughly $22,000 a year, the family is officially poor. Our series, Economy 4.0, is all about how to make the global economy work better for more people, including, in particular, those who fall below that line, which is why Marketplace's David Brancaccio is here to explain why the Census Bureau is about to come out with a new way to measure who is officially poor in this country. Hello, David.
Hey there, Kai.
All right, so no pressure here, but what's wrong with the old poverty line?
Well, it was mainly based on food prices. They haven't changed it since the 1960s, and it used to be what a family needs for food multiplied for some reason times three. But a modern household budget, food is much smaller percentage. And other things like healthcare costs are higher. So they're trying to a new adjustment. The Census Bureau has been working on this for quite some time. And what will be called the supplemental poverty measure will be out next week.
Lovely for statisticians, does not roll trippingly off the tongue, though. Supplementary poverty measure.
Yeah, it's the Census Bureau is not known for its wackiness, but it's important stuff because this is what they're going to do. If a family at the lower end of the income scale, for instance, is paying for childcare, that should be factored in, the government is saying. If they are paying for medical expenses, that is factored in and makes them look poor. However, government benefits, like if you're getting food stamps or some help with healthcare copays, those are factored in and make you look a bit richer. And where you live is crucial because a poverty line in Fort Smith, Arkansas, where the cost of living is lower, will be different from L.A. or New York.
Yeah, let me back you up for a minute. You said, if you're making these payments, it will make you look poorer. And it occurs to me that this is not about the actual people in question themselves. It's about the analysis and the statistics and statisticians, right?
Yeah, that's a great point, Kai. It's not like yesterday you're poor, tomorrow you're not under this new supplemental thing. This is about targeting government programs. Billions of dollars are at stake. Here's Tim Smeeting, director of the Institute for Research on Poverty.
Right now, if you look at the official poverty measures, Congress doesn't know what the $75 billion of SNAP, food stamps, and the $75 billion of refundable federal tax credits, what they did to fight poverty. They will know the day after the SPM is released.
So this is going to be a more complex calculation, right? A more complex indicator.
More nuanced is what they will say.
Okay. But nuance or complexity, do we benefit by getting more granular?
We may. Here's the example. If you go out of the United States, go to a poor country, a developing country, the typical standard of poverty, you know what it is. It's an individual who makes less than $1.25 a day. They can do better than that. And so the United Nations recently adopted a pretty complex new index called, ready for it, the Multidimensional Poverty Index. But how they do it is really interesting. They'll take a look at a family. Do you have a dirt floor, they'll ask. Do you have a fridge? Or quite tragically, have you lost a child? They'll factor this kind of stuff in. 10 indicators. Sabina Alkire from the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative argues this will cancel out some of the contradictions of the old way of looking at poverty.
So if you are only malnourished, you could be a fashion model. You might not actually be malnourished because you are poor. If you cook with wood, it could be you have a lovely fireplace in a separate cooking area. It's not a deprivation. So to count as multidimensionally poor for us, you have to be deprived in 30% of our dimensions. And that means that we are looking at people who really are poor. We're not looking at illiterate millionaires.
So you're totally right. Unless governments, the UN, actually help use numbers like this to lift people out of poverty, they are just statistics.
David Brancaccio from our series Economy 4.0. David, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Coming up in Napa, California, better housing, better workers.
We noticed that there were fellows who were sleeping in vans and sleeping in buses. And so we thought, how can we have this happen to a workforce that supports us?
But first, let's do the numbers. A European bailout that still remains murky pulled markets down today. The Dow Industrials fell 276 points, 2.25% closed at 11,955. The Nasdaq peeled off 52 points, about 1.9%, closed at 2684. The S&P 500 down 31 points. That's nearly 2.5%, finished at 1253. All that came against the backdrop of what you have to say is a terrific month. The Dow up 9.5%, the S&P 500 up 10.8%, its best October in 20 years. The Nasdaq popped up 11.1%. Still, bank stocks took a hit today. Morgan Stanley unloaded 8.75%. Citigroup and Bank of America each gave up 7%. Honda Motors took a wrong turn, costing its stock 8%. Net profit at the company sank by more than half in the third quarter. The price of the 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for September. The Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rates and the economy. And any foodies out there tired of candy? How about a little fruit? National Fig Week begins tomorrow. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The weather today in Los Angeles, a balmy 76 degrees, light breeze. Not ideal for trick-or-treating. It's a little warm, but it's bearable. In Newtown, Connecticut, freezing with a foot of snow thanks to that crazy storm this past weekend. Most assuredly not bearable for trick-or-treating, which is going to put a dent in the activities on Main Street in Newtown tonight. Every year, thousands of trick-or-treaters show up for Halloween. So many that actually providing all that candy turns into a substantial enterprise. Gordon and Lana Williams live on Main Street in Newtown. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Mrs. Williams, might I ask, do I hear it right that Halloween has actually been canceled in Newtown, Connecticut, horrible as that may be?
The trick-or-treating is postponed until next Saturday because we have a lot of power lines down, and they're afraid that it's not safe for the children to be out.
Sure,
we had a very fluke snowstorm, and 96% of the town
lost power, which was better than some towns, which lost 100%.
Tell me what Main Street is like on your typical Halloween, would you, Mrs. Williams?
Well, we moved into this house 20 years ago, having lived in another part of Newtown. And when we moved here, I asked my neighbors how many to expect for trick-or-treating, and they said, oh, maybe 100.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was what we had 20 years ago, but last year we had 3,500.
No, come on, really? That's like an industry. That's not a holiday. So if you go to the corner drugstore, Mr. Williams, and you spend $2 on a bag of candy, you probably have to buy like 150 bags of candy for 3,500 people. This is not cheap.
Well, last year we didn't buy any because it had gotten to the point where I said, I don't want to do this anymore.
What'd you do? Did you turn off the lights and just stay quiet inside?
I would have done that, except my husband wouldn't let us.
And I'm in the Lions Club, and one of our Lions kept sending out emails that I was the only Lion that lived on Main Street and that I was going bankrupt. So we just had a wonderful outpouring of bags of candy from the Lions. In addition, Trinity Church, which is two doors from us, they always raise money and contribute a couple bags of candy to all of the residents of the part of Main Street that would be trick-or-treated.
So did you have supplies laid in for this year already?
I counted that we have, and this is counting every little inch-long Tootsie Roll.
Oh, yeah, they all count, man. You kidding me?
I counted that we had 1,562 or something like that pieces of candy. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to go out on Sunday and buy more.
Yeah.
Of course, we had a little over a foot of snow, so we didn't go anywhere.
Well, it'll all keep till next weekend, right?
Right.
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, very good. Good luck, and I hope the weather turns better for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gordon and Lionel Williams on Main Street in Newtown, Connecticut. This was not the easiest of harvests for farmers in at least a couple of states. New immigration laws in Alabama and Georgia meant fewer Hispanic workers were willing to take the risks involved in showing up for work. On the other side of the country, though, it's a very different story. Napa, California has embraced migrant labor. The region, famous for its wine, also has some of the country's best farm worker housing, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The grape harvest is just about finished in Napa Valley. Teams of Hispanic men move fast along row after row of grapevines. They slice the grapes off in bunches, tossing them into a bucket that they kick along with their feet.
Very, very little of the work that we do in the vineyard is done by machine. 99% is done by hand.
Buenos días, Antonio.
Pat Garvey owns a family vineyard and winery called Flora Springs. About 20 years ago, he realized that many of the people who worked for him didn't have a place to live.
We noticed that there were fellas who were sleeping in vans and sleeping in buses. And so we thought, you know, how can we do that? How can we have this happen to a workforce that supports us?
In fact, it happens to farm workers everywhere. The Department of Agriculture says farm workers endure some of the worst housing in the country. They often live in overcrowded dormitories or in shacks without running water. In Napa, some of the big vineyards used to provide housing, but the expenses and regulations became too much of a burden. That left low-wage workers without many options for shelter.
Years ago, I found about 40 farm workers living under a bridge.
Angel Calderon is the manager at River Ranch. It's one of three local centers that offer a bed and three meals for $12 a night. That fee covers half the budget. Growers pay the other half. In a large rec room, Hispanic men watch TV or shoot pool. Some have papers to work here legally, some don't. The center doesn't ask. Moises Sanchez says he's legal. He's worked in Napa for almost four decades, going back to Mexico for 3 months each year.
Before the center existed, I would start to worry 2 or 3 months before I needed to return to Napa. Where will I live? The difference now is that if I come here, there's a place for me to live.
Now that he's got access to stable housing, Sanchez has brought his 29-year-old son, Elias, with him.
The cheap rent allows Elias to save money for his education back in Mexico.
I came here mainly to work a little and make money for my studies. I'm preparing for a career as a veterinarian.
Manager Angel Calderon gave me a tour.
This is a typical room here.
It looks a bit like a college dorm room. Two beds, some personal stuff, a computer, a small refrigerator. The walls are plastered with posters of cars and pinup girls in colorful bikinis.
By this time, you see details like family pictures.
The total budget for all three centers runs a little more than $1 million a year. Vintners pay almost half of that in the form of a voluntary assessment, $10 per acre. Back at the vineyard, Pat Garvey says the assessment costs him around $6,000 a year. But that saves him money on training new workers.
We don't turn over our personnel that much. If we do add anybody, it's maybe a cousin or it's a friend, somebody from the same pueblo down in Mexico.
The center gives 180 lucky migrant workers a temporary home, but River Ranch manager Angel Calderon says there are still enough homeless workers to fill two more centers.
It's easy to find 12 people in the garage, sleeping in the garage.
Farmworker housing in Napa is among the best in the country, but it still has a ways to go before it shelters all the guys now living in garages or camping under bridges. In Napa, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on this All Hallows Eve in which I stand up for what really counts as licorice and what simply doesn't. Comes to us by way of an FDA report that adults over the age of 40 who eat more than 2 ounces of black licorice a day for 2 weeks straight are at risk for heart arrhythmia. So, in all seriousness, be careful. But my point is actually this. The red stuff, apparently, is okay. To which I say the red stuff? Red vines? Strawberry vines? It's not really licorice. I don't care what you say. You will never convince me. That's it. That's all I got. Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today the Dow fell 276 points. That's 2.25%. The NASDAQ peeled off 52 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 lost 31 points, nearly 2.5%. Yeah, no, not red vines. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, democracy and climate change.
In the period leading up to elections, we find greater evidence of deforestation.
Freakonomics Radio, as only they can do it. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.